I think I should change the lecture to cryogenics, but anyway. Yesterday's lecture was Introduction to the Standard Model, and I didn't quite finish that. I'll finish that this morning and then turn to quantum electrodynamics, which is my real topic today. And what I still need to do is talk about the basic interactions and in a qualitative way. I described yesterday the basic particles in nature, at least the fundamental particles, at least as we thought they were in the 60s and as we think they are now, two versions. And now I will turn to the fundamental interactions. So first we have the strong interactions. And the strong interactions, maybe I should try to use. The strong interactions act on some subset of the particles, the ones we call hadrons, such as the proton, the neutron, and the pions. And that was in the old point of view. In the modern point of view, they act on the quarks. The role of the strong interactions in nature is that they are responsible for nuclear binding. And we could not have anything like the physics or the world or the biology that we have without a variety of nuclei. And so they are bound together by the strong force, but also energy production in stars, which is so the ultimate source of solar energy and of most of the energy that we make use of. And of course, as well as in reactors and nuclear weapons. The second force, and I will continue this, but let me just list the forces first. The next one is the electromagnetic. And this, of course, acts on electrically charged particles. The proton, the charged pions, and now the electron and muon and so forth. It also acts to some extent on even the neutron, because it does have a dipole moment, but it doesn't have any direct electric charge. And of course, the electron and muon are completely blind to the strong force. And this is the most familiar interaction. It's associated with atoms, and crystals, and molecules, and chemistry, and chemical energy, electromagnetic radiation, all associated with this interaction. Then we have what is called the weak interactions. And these are less familiar in everyday life, but they act on all known particles. So not only the proton and neutron and electron, but also on neutrinos, which are neutral particles, which are completely insensitive to these forces. And they are responsible for things like beta decay. Neutron goes to proton, electron, and antineutrino. And many other beta decays, many other processes, but this is the most familiar. And one might ask, well, what good is that? I mean, couldn't we live without beta decay? And the answer is no. we really need the weak force in nature to have anything like the physical world that we know, because you need the weak force as one of the ingredients in nucleosynthesis. I already said we need this great variety of nuclei in order to have this great variety of atoms, in order to have materials as we know it. But where did those nuclei come from? The strong force says that they can exist if you have an appropriate arrangement of protons and neutrons. But the universe presumably started from a hot Big Bang, and at some very early stage, say a second after the Big Bang, the only strongly interacting particles around were protons and neutrons. And nucleosynthesis describes the processes in nature in which the heavy nuclei were formed in the first place, ultimately to be swept up when the Earth formed and to be the basis of materials. And nucleosynthesis is pretty well understood. It happened in the Big Bang, that is, in the first couple of minutes, the helium and lithium and deuterium were formed. They're created in stars. Stellar burning creates nuclei, and then the very heavy nuclei in supernovae, so-called type 2 or core collapse supernovae. So these all play a role, essential role, in having the type of world that we know and love. Now there's two other forces. One is gravity. And this acts on everything. And it is always attractive. These other forces can be attractive or repulsive depending on the circumstance, but gravity is always attractive. And that's very important because gravity is incredibly weak, as I'll display quantitatively in a second, compared to the other forces. And the only reason that we know about it is because it's always attractive. So, for example, the gravitational attraction between the sun and the Earth is more important than the electromagnetic, just because the sun and the Earth are approximately equal numbers of positive and negative charges, but they all add up for gravity. So this is, of course, important for everyday physics, weight, and solar system binding, and the stars, galaxies. A star generates its energy because gravity causes it to tends to collapse until the center heats up so much that nuclear reactions can occur. The fourth force that we know about is the Higgs. This is referred to usually by particle physicists as a Yukawa interaction, although it's not the one that Yukawa postulated to hold nuclei together. And this acts on all known particles, well, at least all known fermions. And it is generates mass, as we will eventually see. The field associated with the Higgs boson acts as something like a molasses, and things moving through it obtain effective masses. So that's its role in nature. And of course, the quantum of this, the Higgs particle, was only discovered in the last couple of years. Now, let me continue this chart. The origin of these forces, I'm going to draw Feynman diagrams. The origin, as in the old days, before we knew about quarks, was the Yukawa theory, pion exchange. And you can substitute negative pions or rho mesons, etc. Yes, sir?
Regarding Higgs, you've stressed that it acts on all known fermions, but what about bosons? Like, is there
it acts on the so-called the W and Z bosons of the weak interactions as well.
Okay, but are there particular bosons that the Higgs does not?
It doesn't act on the photon. Doesn't act on the gluon of the strong interactions.
Okay.
Yes. Yes, sir.
What about neutrinos? Is it?
Well, the neutrino is sort of a special case, but certainly the Higgs acts on it. The neutrino mass is very tiny, and as I'll try to get to much later in the course, although I'll hint at it a little bit later today, there's two possible mechanisms for neutrino mass, but in both cases, the Higgs has to act on it and play a role. So there was another question? Yes. I'm regarding it as a separate force because it's really associated with the exchange of the spin zero Higgs boson. All of the interactions are working together simultaneously in nature, so it's to some extent it's just an arbitrary separation. At any rate, this was the old Yukawa model, exchange of a pion or other particle, and here the potential is, potential energy is some e to the minus m pi r over r, where m pi is the pion mass. The strength, by some measure, is g pi squared over 4 pi. G pi is just the amplitude to emit or absorb a pion at the vertex. And the g pi squared over 4 pi is about 14, so it's very. That's why it's strong. The range over which it's important, well, it's an exponentially falling force, so we say the range is 1 over m pi, which is 10 to the minus 13 centimeters, which is a Fermi. And that's a typical size of a nucleus. And of course, that was what was measured and what allowed Yukawa originally to predict the pion mass. That's within the Yukawa theory with protons and neutrons. Within quantum chromodynamics, it's a somewhat different story. Within QCD, the basic entities are really spin one particles called gluons, acting on quarks, say UDD, associated with that extra color quantum number I mentioned yesterday. I don't want to get into the gluon is massless, but I don't want to get into the details of the strength at this point because it's a complicated story that depends on the distance. I will merely say that if you have the some interaction strength at this vertex, then the gs squared over 4 pi is about 0.1, roughly, when measured at high energies, at typical scales. This is an energy-dependent quantity, but this is when one measures at, say, an energy of about 100 GeV. So it's much weaker in this perspective, and how one connects these two points of view is a very complicated subject that I'll say a little bit about in this course. Of course, electromagnetism is due ultimately to the exchange of a photon, which is spin one, and between two charged particles, say between electron and proton. The potential is E squared over R, and alpha, which is E squared over 4 pi, is about 1 over 137, so it's much weaker by 2 to 3 orders of magnitude compared to the strong force, depending on how you characterize it or what effective theory. The range is infinite. That means the photon is massless. We say it's infinite range. Really, it falls off like 1 over r potential, but the terminology one uses is the range refers to the exponential part. The weak force is due, say beta decay, is actually due to the exchange of a very massive spin 1 object called the W boson. And then there's another neutral one that was predicted by the electroweak unification. And this has a potential that is g squared e to the minus mwr over r, where g is the coupling that occurs at this vertex. And the the effective strength, I don't want to quote g itself. What's really relevant in things like beta decay at low energies is something like g squared e squared over mw squared, where e is the energy that's associated with the decay. And we'll perhaps get an example of that later. So this is what really characterizes the effective strength in weak decay. And this is typically 10 to the minus 11 for an energy scale of an MeV, which is typical of a nuclear beta decay or a neutron decay. And the range, well, the W mass is about 80 GeV, about 80 times the mass of the proton. So the range is 1 over MW, and that's about 10 to the minus 16 centimeters. So it's very short range. Gravity, well, we think, although as I emphasized yesterday, this is really hypothetical. We don't really know that this is the case. But it seems like it should be the exchange of a massless spin 2 particle called the graviton. And a spin 2, that's associated with the fact that you have tensors in general relativity. And the spin 2 nature is what makes it always attractive. The nature of the force depends on the spin of the particle. And for spin 2, it's always attractive. The basic, of course, the potential is the Newtonian potential. Yes?
So aren't there any other spins for which you can have an attractive force?
The well, the spin 0 first of all, it depends on the relative sign of these. If you have the same sign of the coupling at each side, let's talk about that case. Then, and for that situation, then the spin 1 will always be, say, repulsive for like sign and attractive if you replace one of the particles by its antiparticle. But if you had two different particles with different signs of their couplings, then you can reverse all that. But it does switch when you reverse one particle by its antiparticle. With gravity, spin 2, it's always the same sign, providing that the coupling has the same sign on each side, whether it's particles or antiparticles. For spin 0, it's also not reversed when you go from replace one by its antiparticle. But there, you really could have different signs at the interaction vertices. It's not necessarily universal, like in the case of gravity. OK, so we have Newtonian potential. And of course, Gn m1 m2 is 10 to the minus 38 if you pick, say, something like a proton mass, say 1 GeV. So you see it's incredibly weak. And again, it's only because it's always attractive and you've got lots and lots of particles in the sun and in the earth or in your body that add up coherently. And the Higgs interaction, well, there's some spin zero particle called the Higgs. And basically, the potential in this case would be M1, M2. It does depend, it's associated with the generation of the masses, and so it's not surprising that it's proportional to the masses. And this was actually MW, I'm sorry, not M. So it's an exponential fall off. And in this case, the M1, M2 over MW squared is around 10 to the minus 4 for, again, M1 equals M2 equals 1 GeV. But if you were to take, say, an electron here, which has 1,000 times smaller mass, then the force is much, coupling is much smaller. If you take a top quark, which is a mass of 100 GeV approximately, you get a much stronger interaction. So it really depends on what particles are involved. And in this case, the range is, again, about 10 to the minus 16 centimeters. The Higgs mass is about 126 GeV, a little bigger than the W mass. And I'm not keeping factors of 2 and so forth here. So that's sort of the summary of the known interactions and their properties. And the rest of the course is basically to develop these ideas in a quantitative way, how they're described mathematically, and what the experimental consequences are, and the tests, something about the tests that went into this. Okay, are there any questions? Okay, so now I want to turn to quantum electrodynamics. And I'm not going to, you know, repeat all the things you saw in your field theory courses in the fall. And I'm not going to develop the mathematics of it very much. I just want to emphasize a couple things and then talk about the experimental tests of QED. So let's consider, first of all, a free electron of charge Q equals minus E. Remember, E is always positive in my notation. And for different particles, I will always label their, I will list their charge by some quantity Q. I'm inconsistent here. Sometimes I will say Q is minus 1, and sometimes I'll say it's minus E. But from the context, it will always be obvious. For a free electron, there is a Lagrangian density, which is psi bar I d slash minus m psi, where psi is a four-component spinner. It really has a hidden index alpha running from 1 to 4, and this is a row spinner and a column spinner, and this is a 4x4 matrix. D slash is gamma mu d by dx mu, which is also just denoted gamma mu delta mu. And gamma mu are the 4x4 Dirac matrices. Each of them has a indices alpha beta, the matrix indices, and then the mu is the Lorentz index. So there are four of these. And one does not need to specify the exact form of these. There's various useful representations, but the key point is that the anti-commutator, and I denote anti-commutators by curly brackets, is 2 g mu nu. It's also essential that gamma mu adjoint is equal to gamma mu gamma 0, gamma 0 gamma mu gamma 0, which is the same as gamma lower mu. Remember, my metric is 1 minus 1 minus 1 minus 1. And this is conditions needed to get proper kinetic energy. Psi bar is just the adjoint, so it's a row spinner, times gamma zero, and this is called the Dirac adjoint. Okay, so you've seen all this stuff and worked with all this before, right? Okay. Let me just, for reference sake, actually write the form. The solution to the Euler-Lagrange equations gives you the expression for this free field. And that is a function of space-time. And it's just the integral over momentum space components, 2 pi cubed 2 ep. Ep is just the energy of an on-shell electron. M is the mass of the electron. P vector is the 3 momentum. And then sum over 2 spin states. And now there's a momentum space spinner times an operator, e to the minus I p dot x, plus another spinner called the V spinner times operator B adjoint of P and S times E to the plus I P dot X, where U and V are just momentum space spinners, which are solutions to the free Dirac equation. So P slash minus M UPS is equal to P slash plus M VPS is equal to 0. And S just represents the two possible spin states of the electron, which are usually taken to be helicity states, but can also refer to a fixed axis. APS acting, the adjoint of this acting on the vacuum just gives you an electron of spin P and momentum P, spin S, and B dagger PS just creates an antiparticle, a positron, momentum P and S. And the A and B without the adjoints just are the annihilation operators. And they satisfy the usual harmonic on oscillator algebra, except that they anti-commute instead of commute. So the psi can describe the destruction of an electron. If you have a psi in a Feynman diagram, I will take bottom to be initial state and top to be final. So you could have an electron coming into a diagram, and a psi would just describe the annihilation of that electron. Or it can create a positron. So psi also, psi can also create a positron. I'm just going to make it more confusing. Let's just leave it at this. The psi has in it the creation operator for a positron or the annihilation operator for the electron, and the adjoint of psi is the reverse. Okay, so that's the free field QED. So everything okay? Note that there is a global U1 symmetry. That is, if I replace psi of x by a new field, psi prime of x, which is e to the minus I beta psi of x, beta is a real number, then psi dagger of x is replaced by psi prime dagger of x, which is e to the plus I beta psi prime dagger of x, psi prime of x. If I make this, define psi primes in this way, then one has that L0 of psi and psi dagger is equal to L0 of psi prime and psi prime dagger. We say that there is an invariance. The form of the Lagrangian density is not changed when you make this transformation or replace one field by the other. This is called the U1 symmetry. U1, remember, represents the 1 by 1 unitary, it's the group of 1 by 1 unitary matrices. And a 1 by 1 unitary matrix is the world's most complicated way of saying a phase factor, e to the minus I beta. And so obviously the product of e to the minus I beta times e to the minus I alpha, for example, is e to the minus I beta plus alpha. So the set of these phase factors are elements of a group, and this is the multiplication law of the group. So that's all very well and good. We have this symmetry. And this symmetry is called global. Global means beta is a constant. It does not depend on a position in space and time. However, there's another type of symmetry that one is interested in, known as a local symmetry, or also known as a gauge symmetry. And that would correspond to psi of x going to psi prime of x equals to e to the minus I beta of x psi of x. And the corresponding result for psi dagger. Beta is now in a local symmetry. Beta is a differentiable function of space and time. L naught is not invariant. Because if you were to calculate L naught of psi prime and psi prime dagger is not equal to L naught of psi dagger. And that's because there are derivatives acting on psi. And the derivatives, if I were to calculate L naught of psi prime, I'll just write psi prime, it's implicit in psi prime dagger as well. That's psi prime adjoint. Then if you look up there, it's I d mu slash minus m psi prime of x. And now if I substitute in the expression for psi prime in terms of psi, that's psi bar e to plus I beta of x, I d slash mu minus m e to the plus minus I beta of x psi. And now the point is the derivative here can act on psi. It's one of the things it can do. And for the term in which the derivative acts on psi, I can just pull the exponential through, and that term is like we had before. And the term involving the mass is the same. However, you can also have the derivative act on the exponential. So this is equal to psi bar times I d mu slash minus m plus d mu beta of x. I don't have a mu. I'm sorry. This is just d slash. What am I writing? Okay. So this is plus gamma mu d mu beta of x psi of x, where here the derivative is acting on the beta. In other words, this part would just give me the original Lagrangian, but I get an extra term here, so I do not have an invariance. Okay, well, if you had never heard of gauge invariance before, you'd probably say, so what? Who cares? Well, the point is, first let's look at the history. The history of electrodynamics started with classical electrodynamics, and from experiment, Maxwell and others formulated the Maxwell equations, and it was recognized that there was a gauge invariance of classical electrodynamics. And that gauge invariance carries over into quantum mechanics, provided that your electron field have a transformation, your electron wave function state has a transformation similar to this one. We now turn the logic around, and we'll from now on take gauge invariance as a starting point, and we will see that gauge invariance associated with different gauge groups, this one is U1, can be the starting point to determine what the nature of the interactions are. Now, to some extent, it's a tautology. I mean, we observed over decades and decades and decades of work that nature seems to prefer gauge invariant theories. And these first three interactions are all gauge theories. And this can also be considered a gauge theory. The Higgs interaction is not really by itself a gauge theory. But we've just inverted the whole logic because it seems to work. And we're trying to describe nature. Okay, so my free field is not invariant, but I can easily generate a gauge invariant theory. And I don't know how many of you have actually taken an advanced classical mechanics course that involved Lagrangians and minimal electromagnetic substitutions and so forth. So about half of you have. It was already recognized that long ago that in Lagrangian classical mechanics treated from a Lagrangian point of view, that you could incorporate electromagnetism by what's called the minimal electromagnetic substitution. The minimal electromagnetic substitution simply says that P mu, for momentum, in the Lagrangian for a free field is replaced by P mu minus the electric charge of the particle that you're talking about times the vector potential, electromagnetic vector potential. And of course, in quantum mechanics, P mu is synonymous with the derivative. So minimal electromagnetic substitution simply says that one can actually get a gauge invariant theory if you start with the free field, which is not gauge invariant, and replace the derivative by this minimal electromagnetic substitution. A mu is a new field, is the spin one vector field that we in QED will associate with the photon or the electromagnetic field. And basically it says that we replace that free field Lagrangian by a new Lagrangian, I d slash minus m psi, where d slash, well, d mu, d slash is gamma mu d mu, and d mu is the ordinary derivative that we started with, plus I times the charge of the particle times the vector potential, which in this case, since q is minus e, is d mu minus e a minus I e a mu. This is called the gauge covariant derivative. Yes?
I can understand how this works mathematically, but how do you sort of justify it physically? What would you...
Well, that's what I tried to get at before. You could not... We are not at a stage of physics in which you can just start from nothing and by pure reason justify something like this as the way nature has to work. What we're trying to do is describe the nature that we probed experimentally, and this is the prescription that does seem to work. And it's turning the whole... In this case, one can simply say we know from classical electrodynamics that there is a gauge invariance. And in fact, this is the only way to promote the free field theory, relativistic free field theory of the electron to a renormalizable gauge invariant theory. It's unique. I'm stating that. I haven't proved it, obviously. And then we have observed, after decades and decades of struggle, that the strong and weak interactions also can be described by generalizations of this. So if you wanted to put it on a somewhat quasi-axiomatic formulism, you could just forget about nature and say, let us consider gauge invariant theories. These are the consequences. And oh, by the way, in the end, I get out this theory that happens to agree perfectly with our world. But of course, it was much more difficult historically. Okay, so this is called the gauge covariant derivative. And let me, it's very straightforward to show that d mu prime of psi prime, which is, oh, I forgot to state that under a gauge transformation, not only does the electron transform, but a mu is replaced by a mu prime, which is a mu minus I over E times the derivative of beta. That's the transformation that's necessary for the gauge field. And this starts to look much more like the familiar thing from classical electrodynamics. And F mu nu is the field strength tensor, which is D mu A nu minus D nu A mu. And clearly, this is the same as F mu nu prime, because the two terms just involve second derivatives of beta and cancel here. OK, under that, One has, and I'm just going to write it, because, and you can easily verify, that d mu prime psi prime, which is d mu, plus minus I over E A mu prime. That's what I mean by D mu prime. And then I have psi prime. And this is equal to D mu minus I over E times A mu. This is minus IE. Okay. So A mu I over E D mu beta. This is without the prime. And this is E to the I beta psi. And if I'm extremely lucky, wait, I've got an I missing somewhere here. Yeah. Yeah. I'm terribly sorry. There's not an I there. Okay, now I still have a sign wrong somewhere. I'm sorry. I get totally confused by this E, Q equals minus E business myself, and so I'm always going to make sign mistakes. And A mu is E. Oh, there was a minus sign there. That's what my problem is. Okay, you should be able to see that this is E to the minus beta times D mu psi, because if you just look at, that's what this part is, pulling the exponential through, and then the derivative acting on the exponential just cancels this term. So the gauge covariant derivative basically is transparent to this e to the minus I beta. It can pull right through it. The gauge term compensates, and we end up, therefore, with the L of psi prime and A prime is equal to L of psi and A. And this is a gauge invariant theory. The consequence is gauge invariance requires a spin one massless A mu, a term like m squared a mu, m a squared a mu, which would be a mass term, is not invariant, so you can't write down a mass term without messing up the gauge invariance. And we'll see in the Higgs mechanism a loophole to that, but for now, we're not doing that yet. And that means it can mediate a long-range force, and the form is prescribed. So in terms of a Feynman diagram, you could have, for example, an initial and a final electron and a photon coming in. And the Feynman rule corresponding to that would be the final, the U spinner for the final state times an IE gamma mu times the spinner for the initial state, times the epsilon mu, the polarization vector of the photon. So the point is that the gauge invariance requires the existence of a massless spin one boson, and it actually prescribes the form of the interaction up to E. E, that's taken from experiment. That's E is the, called the gauge coupling constant. And it must be taken from experiment. least of our present level of understanding. And this, of course, reduces in some appropriate non-relativistic limit to the Coulomb potential and to classical electrodynamics. So gauge invariance is the starting point, and the rest of the strong and weak interactions are going to be basically the same thing, but starting with different symmetry groups and different representations. Are there any questions? Okay, in the remaining time, let me say something about the tests. Quantum electrodynamics is incredibly precisely tested. I believe it's the most successful theory in physics, or in the sense of the most precise quantitative tests. And perhaps the most important is the A sub E, which is the anomalous magnetic moment of the electron. Now recall that the magnetic moment operator in quantum mechanics for the electron is minus G mu B S. And this G is not a gauge coupling. This is just the Landé G factor for the electron that you learned in quantum mechanics. And mu B is E H bar over 2mc, which is really E over 2m. M is the electron mass. And S is sigma over 2 is the electron spin operator. Classically, you would expect this G factor to be 1, but in fact, it's very close to 2, and that was explained by the Dirac equation. Dirac predicted that it should be 2 instead of 1, and that's a relativistic effect. But it's not exactly 2. It's really 2 times 1 plus a small correction called the anomalous magnetic moment, and this is due to quantum electrodynamics. The Dirac equation has relativistic kinematics for the electron, but it doesn't have a quantized electromagnetic field. It still treats the electromagnetism classically. QED also quantizes the electromagnetic field, and that leads to a correction. In fact, I'm going to diagrammatically indicate the G factor just by some Feynman diagram, and this is a G factor. You have to delve into the details of the vertex connecting a photon to the electron, not only the gamma mu part, but the effect of all the higher order corrections, and look at what actually generates the magnetic moment term. And I don't have time to do that, but I will simply say that the lowest if you just treated this interaction, which I guess I'm, well, here and just didn't do higher order effects, then when you expand those spinners and identify the magnetic moment piece, you would get the 2. But then the first QED correction involves just exchanging a photon across the vertex. This was calculated by Schwinger many years ago, and it gives an AE of, well, AE and QED, let me set up the notation, is a power series in alpha over pi, and the notation that I will adopt from the recent research papers is that the coefficient of alpha over pi to the n N is the number of loops in the diagram, and it multiplies alpha over pi. Alpha is, of course, e squared over 4 pi, around 1 over 137. This was the Schwinger calculation, and it yields that the AE2 is equal to a half. So in other words, AE, the first term, is alpha over 2 pi. This was calculated in like around 1950. And if you're interested in the calculation, I actually do that in great detail in my textbook. However, there are higher order calculations. There are, for example, there are two loop diagrams, and there are many. There are ones like this, and there's ones like this. And altogether, the number of diagrams that one has to calculate grows very rapidly with the number of loops. And in fact, this quantity has been calculated in QED to the 5-loop level by Kinoshita, who's basically spent his lifetime doing it. So there are 1, 7, 72, 891, and 12,672 Feynman diagrams at 1-loop, 2-loop, 3-loop, 4-loop, and 5-loop. And basically, I will write out the prediction. The prediction is I'll write it in a moment. For example, the alpha over pi to the fifth is 9.16 plus or minus 0.58 alpha over pi to the fifth. I'll just write the last contribution. And the uncertainty is because there are Feynman parametric integrals which have to be done numerically, and the errors are basically associated with the errors in those integrals. There are also, that's the pure QED diagrams. There are also contributions from the strong and weak interactions. For example, that loop up there, instead of just an electron or a muon or tau, you also can have hadrons. That's a strong interaction correction, even though it's a QED quantity. And there are also diagrams involving those W bosons and weakly interacting particles. So you can't take them totally in isolation. Those have to be considered also. Anyway, the experiment, and this is done in a so-called Penning trap, a configuration of static, electric, and magnetic fields that allows the electron to be held in place for years. And the best experiments are now done at Harvard. Give AE experimental 11596521807.3 with an uncertainty of 0.28 in the there times 10 to the minus 12, which is an experiment accurate to 0.24 parts per billion. Now, the theory, you actually need to know alpha independently. And so to get the theoretical prediction, you need to use the second most precise measurement to determine alpha. And that turns out to be involved the Rydberg constant in atomic physics combined with some tricky other things to get necessary masses that go into the Rydberg. But so that yields a theoretical prediction of I didn't even write it out. Let me just write it as AE experiment minus AE theory is minus 1.06 plus or minus 0.082 times 10 to the minus 12. So it's, and I must have, that's an extra zero. So it says they agree to just almost at one sigma, at about the 1.2 standard deviation level, they agree. And this is, in many ways, the most precise prediction in physics. Now, it actually makes sense. The experimenters like to present the results that way. I'll simply say most theorists turn it around and say, well, this is the most precise measurement in physics. And so let's just use this along with the theory as our most precise measurement of alpha. And that's much more precise than the one you get from the Rydberg. And then everything else can be predicted. But it's just a turning around of the logic a little bit. But at any rate, at the level of about 10 to the minus 12, there is agreement between the two most precise determinations of alpha. And there are many other measurements involving Lamb shifts and muonic atoms and quantum Hall effects and many other things that are almost as good a precision, incredibly precise. Let me conclude. So I won't go into those in detail, but I just want to mention two other, at least claimed, important tests. I'll mention several, but I only can say a word or two because of time constraint. One is that the photon is predicted to be massless. Otherwise, the whole thing doesn't work. And experimentally, the limit on the photon mass is about 10 to the minus 18 electron volts. And this has to do with the magnetic field of the sun. Don't ask me the details because I don't know. If somebody wants to look it up and tell me, they're welcome to. Another prediction is that the electric charge of the photon should vanish. And it is has been claimed in one experiment that this is less than 10 to the minus 46 times E. And this has to do with the fact that certain interference effects involving the photon would, in the presence of magnetic fields, acquire an Aharonov-Bohm phase if there were a charge for the photon and mess up the observations. Again, I don't know the details, but these are pretty precise. Finally, I will say that there's a running of alpha. I believe you heard a little bit about running couplings. Higher order contributions to the photon propagator can be absorbed into an effective alpha that depends on the momentum of the photon. So alpha be replaced by some running alpha. One can predict that effect. It's a logarithmically effect. And it's supposed to increase with energy. And this has been observed experimentally in the range of between a few and 100 GeV. It's not very precise, but it has been observed. There are two anomalies that are not understood. One is the analogous anomalous magnetic moment of the muon, calculated to the same precision, but the experiment and theory differ by a couple of standard deviations. This may well be the effect of new physics beyond the standard model. This is actually much more sensitive to new physics than the anomalous magnetic moment of the electron. And then the muonic Lamb shift. The Lamb shift in muonic hydrogen has been measured to great precision at PSI in Switzerland about 2 years ago. And this is a cleaner experiment than the ordinary electron Lamb shift. And this seems to also differ from what's expected. So I doubt if it's a matter of QED breaking down, but there are always problems on the horizon. Okay, that's all I'm going to say about QED. And tomorrow I will start talking about symmetries in a more serious way, including non-abelian symmetries and building up to the things necessary for the weak and strong interactions. Are there any final questions today? Well, thank you for all coming out in the cold. I appreciate it.